Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
You know, Dan, small businesses in general are looking for ways of reducing costs, their health care costs in particular. Today we have someone, Mike Schroeder, who is president of Brownstone Insurance, who has some very good ideas of how to do that. Mike, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Mike, tell us a little bit about yourself personally, about your company, and what in particular you have to say about how small businesses can save money on health care insurance.
Well, I've been a Buckeye here in Ohio most of my life, for all but about 10 years when I was moving around getting educated and work starting my career. But I've been here in Ohio all this time, and I am in the insurance business, and it's a little scary for me to say, but I've been in the insurance business almost 30 years now. And our company, Roundstone Insurance, was started 14 years ago, and we focus on self-insurance for health insurance, and have been doing so successfully for those past 14 years.
What exactly do you mean by self-insurance? That's a scary word to a lot of people, including myself.
Yeah, that self-insurance means that you take a portion of the risk of the health insurance and you manage and retain it yourself. You know, you still have what they sometimes refer to as partially self-funded, but you still have catastrophic coverage. But why folks do it and why it's becoming ever more popular with the middle market and smaller employers is it allows you to better control your costs. And it also gives you a lot of the information you otherwise wouldn't have to control your costs. So, when you say self-insurance, it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. You're still buying insurance coverage for the catastrophic losses, but you're getting a little more control over those losses that you can manage. And the other big benefit of going this route is if you don't spend the money in the layer that you're retaining or in the risk that you're retaining, you keep the money. The insurance company doesn't keep it. It stays in your own pocket. And so if you really want to take a long-term approach and curtail these costs over a long period of time, the best way to do it is to make sure that you keep the savings when you have them.
Okay, we're going to go into a little bit more detail. Let's say I'm a employer with 75 employees. Would that be a good number to start thinking about self-employment?
Yeah, absolutely.
A 75 employees.
Yes, sir. That's a great company to look at this. You know, you have to keep in mind a company like that is today spending definitely $750,000 and maybe close to $1 million a year on their health insurance for their employees. That's clearly going to be a top two or three expense for the company. And so, and it's an expense that's going up by double digits every year. And so if that employer wants to take control and moderate those annual increases and stop it from doubling every 4 years, they really should take a close look at self-funding or self-insurance. And what that'll do for them is, as I mentioned, it'll give them the information that's driving the cost. It'll give them the ability to control how to curtail and moderate those cost increases. And then lastly, it is a really efficient way to fund it because if you don't spend it, you keep the money. I was going to say, one of the things that we find intriguing as we talk to more and more employers, and particularly those with 75 employees or 100 or 50 employees, is when they recognize that when they look at health insurance, it's a top three expense, but they don't buy it like they buy everything else. So when they go out and they purchase any other supply for their company, or really any other vendor or service provider for the company, they're getting complete and transparent information about the product and what goes into the cost and why it costs this much and so on and so forth. Some basic purchasing ideas. They also figure out how the product can be customized and fit for their own business and how it can apply to their business. And then lastly, if they can take the product and only buy what they need, they keep the savings and they don't pay extra for something they don't use or they don't need. If you take those basic purchasing principles that is applied to almost everything else that business is doing or buying, and then you look at health insurance, they don't buy it that way. And they currently, a lot of these employers, like the 75-employee firm you mentioned, they essentially look at this once a year. They buy a product with no information as to cost. They buy a product that they don't have any control over how it fits into their business. And lastly, they buy a product that if they don't use all of it, they don't keep the money. They basically are going to have to pay a fixed price, and whether that money is used or not, it's a cost they're going to incur. And so what we're telling a lot of these employers is start buying your health insurance like the large Fortune 5 companies are buying it. Start looking at what's going into the cost of the health insurance. Get control over those costs. And lastly, when you don't spend the money, keep it. And if you buy your health insurance like you buy every other product, and you buy your health insurance like the Fortune 5 does, you're going to find out that you're going to save a tremendous amount of money.
Dan, it's all yours.
Thank you. How are you different than these commercials I hear for Medicare and where individuals can pool their cost of health care in an association or a group? How is what you do different than them?
Well, that's individual coverage. We our market is focused on the employer-sponsored health care, where the employer is the plan sponsor, and a lot of that, a lot of those commercials you see for Medicare and so on and so forth, that is very much focused where the individual is buying health insurance. We're focused on employer-sponsored healthcare, and that is by far the largest source of coverage for folks in the United States. Over 170 million approximately people get their health insurance through their employer. It's something like 54% of all people get their health insurance through employer, and that's the market we're focused on. We're not focused on the individual or Medicare, Medicaid markets.
Would your product be a better alternative for corporations than Obamacare?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. So Obamacare is primarily impacts the fully insured market, those folks that buy that fixed cost insurance I mentioned. And our product is outside of many of those Obamacare rules. So a big reason why there's been a dramatic shift into our product is because of employers saying, you know, I'm tired of Washington telling me what I have to do. I want more control. You know, I want more control over how I fund and how I deliver my benefits to my employees. So if you go into our product, you don't eliminate all of the Obamacare rules, but you do eliminate a lot of them. And so that's we're an alternative to the fully insured Obamacare market.
And so when you start eliminating rules, you start eliminating costs.
You got it. No question about
it. Okay. If we try to put this, what you do, into a as a round peg into a round hole, would we say is the best way to describe it employer-sponsored healthcare?
Yes. Yes, that's
okay.
A great description, yeah. For the middle market.
Okay. So how big is that marketplace, and how are you doing in terms of capturing market share?
Well, as I mentioned, the employer-sponsored healthcare is, you know, 170 million folks, so it's very, very large. It's by far it's the largest share of how people get their health insurance. 54% of all Americans. The middle market is a subset of that, but it's still, you know, we're still talking, you know, millions and millions of people getting their health insurance. In terms of folks, you know, it's an interesting, like 6 years ago, you know, you'd look at the statistics. Okay, how many folks are self-funding and how many folks are buying this fixed cost coverage? And for employers with 1,000 or more employees, almost all of them, 98, 99% of employers with 1,000 employees or more are going our route, are going the self-funded route.
Wow.
But you get down into 500 or below 250 employees, 6 years ago it was much smaller. Less than 30% of those employers were self-funding. That has changed. That has changed. And in the last 2 to 3 years, there's been a shift in the amount of, you know, a 30% change of employers with less than 500 employees starting to self-fund and starting to look at products like ours, which is, you know, ours is what's known as a self-funded medical captive. So there's been a dramatic shift. And again, that's in part driven by trying to get away from some of the Obamacare costs, but it's also driven by just the overall cost of health insurance going up so dramatically that these employers say, we got to do something different. Our company has seen similar growth. We have seen year over year 30% increase in our customers. We have more close to 500 employers today that are our customers. We do business in all 50 states, and we don't see any slowdown in these opportunities. And so we're seeing that same similar shift of these middle market employers saying, I want to buy my health insurance in a different way, and I want to do it a lot more like, say, Procter & Gamble and GM, who knows what they're buying and has control over what they're buying. And companies like ours help them do that.
Yeah. I'm curious about in the middle market and smaller market, you indicated that your business is growing, but it's a huge market. What do you think is the reluctance of middle market and small employers not taking a hard look at your what you do or anybody that's a competitor of yours of what they do?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, first off, it's sort of like the conversation. The word self-insurance came up, and everyone's initial reaction is, oh, that's more risky. And then they have to learn more about it and realize that, you know, it's actually less risky. I mean, to stay in a product that you know is going to go up double digits and double every 4 to 5 years, to me, and when you're running a business, that kind of cost increase, that's risky. Whereas here, where you get the catastrophic coverage and you get control, you know, we feel you're managing your risk more. So first off is just getting over the initial reaction of, wow, self-funding is more risky. The other piece of this is, you know, health care costs, the health insurance costs have really risen dramatically in the last couple of years. This last data came out, and they're saying to basically provide health care coverage for a family today is on average across the United States $25,000. So this has now hit the radar screen, and really nobody that's running a business can just ignore health care costs. I mean, they have to look at it. It's risen so much. And once they do that, they're quickly going to gravitate to our funding strategy of self-funding. The other piece of this is historically in self-funding, there were some concerns about volatility and about availability of the access to the doctors. And there has been some product innovation on our part at our company that limits that year-over-year volatility through a pooling mechanism among all of the employers. But in addition, there's a lot more turnkey, accessible access to these networks and to these claims TPAs that used to be reserved just for the larger companies in the past. And the marketplace is really, just through technology and just through market efficiency, now can deliver the same kind of networks that Procter & Gamble buys, you know, can be delivered to the guy that's making refrigerators in Toledo, Ohio. So there's been some product developments in those areas that make it more accessible for the middle market. And, you put it all together, and that's why you see the shift.
I'm curious about your business model from the standpoint of how do you acquire relationships? Do you have a field agency force? Is it done over the internet? What is your market approach?
We distribute through, we're a wholesale distributor, so we distribute through local agents, or we call them advisors, throughout the United States. We also have an internal field, we call them practice leaders or field sales, and they call on these advisors. We do provide and perform some what we call pull-through marketing. You know, my conversation with you today is an attempt at that, where I try to inform these employers in the middle market that there is an alternative to the fixed cost insurance that they've always been buying, and that if they can look at their health care long term, there are these alternative funding strategies that Roundstone offers. So we do market to the employers, but we distribute everything through local advisors throughout the United States, and our practice leaders call on those folks every day.
So you're doing this interview with Don and me today, and 3 o'clock this afternoon, you get three contacts by going mm-hmm. Sending people to your RoundstoneInsurance.com website. How do you decide where those three or four or five or 10 or 20 or 100, where do they go?
So they'll be assigned to our practice leader in that area, and then he will ask two questions. You know, do you want to continue using your current agent or advisor? You know, and their familiarity with captive self-insurance, self-funding, or would you like us to recommend? We have credentialed advisors that we've worked with in the past that know our product very well, know how to implement it very well, and we can make a recommendation of a local advisor. Our practice leaders will kind of determine that with the employer, and then we'll go from there. So if an employer wants to keep its agent or advisor that they've been using for 20 years and that fellow's open to and receptive to a new strategy to fund the benefits and understands it, we're fine with that. However, if the employer is basically saying, you know what, I'm tired of getting the same story every year and I want to make a change, we can facilitate that as well.
Yeah. One quick story, then I'll turn it over to Don. My youngest son told us at Thanksgiving that his employer just announced the new premium and deductible for their group health insurance at where he works. And the way he's done it is that he is covered by his work insurance. His wife and child are covered by her insurance. His premium went up 300%. And his out-of-pocket went to $14,000 deductible. And he was just beside himself that increase in premium is a reduction of his income, but he's never going to get $14,000 worth of deductible before he gets to the insurance company. So he's paying all this money for coverage that he's never going to get because he's got to pay for it most himself. With that, let me throw it back to Don.
Yeah, and let me just comment. There's two things that I'd like to comment. First of all, the reason that's happening is his employer, instead of looking at this from an overall holistic funding approach, is taking the most, you know, easy way, shift it onto the employees. And that's been happening over the last 3 to 5 years. But that they're running out of road. Most middle market employers cannot shift much more to the employees. They just can't afford it. To put things in perspective, today, the average household income is contributing 30% of it towards health insurance. So think
almost
about
as much
that.
As the mortgage payment. Almost as much
right.
as the mortgage payment.
Yeah, the median household budget now has 30% towards health insurance. So a middle market employer or any employer that is going to continue with this practice of shifting the cost increases, ignoring them, but just shifting them to the employees, that road is coming to a dead end. It's just not going to work anymore. And so what they need to do is step back and say, hey, how do I control these cost increases? That's the only choice I have left. And the answer to that is you got to get into a product like Roundstone offers.
Okay, back to Don.
I want to talk about a lot of things, but I'm an employer. I come to you and I say, yes, I'm thinking of self-insuring, et cetera. And I talked to one of your advisors, but basically, I have to commit X dollars to the plan, and you, in effect, become the insurance company after that point. Am I hearing you correctly, Mike?
Yeah, that's right. You know, kind of a good way that we look at it is we're going to put, just like you would if you went to the fixed cost insurer, you know, we're going to put a cost for this company on a per employee basis for them. We're saying this is what your estimate of costs are going to be. And we're going to also give them here's the maximum cost that could be. And then they fund to those levels. So they, just like they do today, they'll pay a premium. The difference is, whereas the premium was all going into the pocket of the insurance company before, we now take that premium and we break it up into three different buckets. One bucket is exclusively for the employer and is reserved to the employer's claims. And if they don't spend it for claims, say, below $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, they keep those savings. The other bucket is a bucket where there's a sharing among all the employers in our pool. And again, if all these employers don't spend those premium dollars, it gets distributed out to all the employers. And then the last bucket goes to an insurance company, our insurance company partners, where if it's for catastrophic coverage. Those are fixed costs, and that money's not coming back, but they can rest assured that, hey, there's a max cost for my health insurance, and I also only pay claims up to a certain dollar amount of, say, like $30,000. So it works very much like what they have been doing, and the employees don't really experience a difference other than what costs they have. But what's different is, what do we do with those premium dollars, and how are they returned when they're not spent for that employer?
But, Mike, what is the average deductible under your plan?
Well, for the employees, it's just what it is, you know, they currently have or what they had historically have had, you know. So, you know, we have planned, and that's the other piece of this, is the employer, as I mentioned, not only do you get full transparency of what's cost and what's driving the cost, but you also get control. So you, as the employer, have control over your plan design. If you want a $500 deductible for your employees, you can do that. If you want the family to have a $2,500 deductible, you can do that. So from the employee perspective, the deductible is much like any plan they've used to. What's different here is now the employer itself has a deductible. And the employer's deductible tends to be, in our programs in the middle market, tends to be anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000 or $40,000, depending on the size of the company. Now, just like an HSA, what's nice about this is if the dollars aren't spent in this employer deductible, which, by the way, typically comprises 60% of the overall premiums, they keep those dollars. They keep those savings, and they're able to roll it over to the next year if they want or whatnot. So the employer has a deductible that is certainly higher than what they've had. They probably have never had their own deductible. But from the employee's perspective, really nothing changes on the deductible side. We've actually had most of our clients reduce the deductible for the employees because they have more money to return to them.
But two things. One, it is not HSA compatible.
No, it is. Yeah, your plan design can have an HSA model sitting underneath it. Absolutely. And most of our employers do have HSAs built into their plan. And they control that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But now the other question, maybe I heard it wrong, there is a maximum. For instance, I had spinal surgery last year, and the bill was over $140,000. But did I hear you correctly? There's a maximum of $30,000, or did I not hear that correctly?
Yeah. So there's two maximums that you're going to want to look at. One is on a per claim basis, and that's the example that your spinal surgery presents. So let's assume that your deductible was $1,000, your employee deductible. So of that $100,000, the employee, just like it normally would with any kind of fully insured product, would pay $1,000. The employer then, and let's assume that the employer has a $20,000 employer deductible, would pay the next $19,000. Okay, the other 80 is paid by the insurance company. Now,
okay,
of that 80, roughly that would go into a shared pool of all the employers and the premiums, and but it's not the obligation of the employer individually. It's not the obligation of the employee individual. Any money left over in that shared pool will come back at the end of the year to all the employers. So that's on a per claim basis, and that's the max that that employer is going to pay is up to $20,000 on a claim. Now, there's also a max for the accumulation of claims. Let's say for whatever strange reason you had a 100 employees that all had a $100,000 claim. We're also going to have put a limit. So at that example of 75 employee firm, they're going to have a max cost of $750,000 or $800,000, where no matter how many $20,000 claims they're responsible for, they're not going to go above that. So there's both a per claim and an aggregate is what they use, the technical term, an aggregate coverage for a max coverage.
Well, Mike, pardon me. I've looked at this industry a long time. We have a site, HSA Finder, which deals with HSAs. And I know what you're saying is true, but and it works. What makes your plan, why don't other large insurance companies pick up something like this rather than the cumbersome system we have today?
Well, candidly, it's in their favor not to disclose the information. From an anti-competitive point of view, if they hold all the data, it's really hard for an employer to move to another insurance company. So they like that feature that's out there today. Number two, they don't. When there's claim savings, they want to keep it. They don't want to have the employer keep it. When you sit down with a large insurance company and. And we partner with reinsurers, by the way, that catastrophic coverage. We work with household names like Nationwide, American National. But the big companies, Aetna, Cigna, those folks, they have made a lot of money on underwriting this premium for the middle market. And they keep any time you don't spend the premium you've paid them, if you don't spend the $750,000 that 75-employee firm was charged, say they only spend $500,000 in claims, that's $250,000 of profit for that insurance company. In our model, very different outcome. We'll give them a max cost of $750,000. We have fixed expenses that'll run about $100,000 on that for the catastrophic coverage. So that leaves $650,000 variable. If they only spend $500,000, they're going to be getting over $100,000 back. And so a large insurance company, when I sit down with them when we were starting our business and I said, this is my model, I think the middle market really needs this kind of approach, they said, we love your product, Mike. It's a great idea, but we don't like it. You're taking dollars out of our pocket, and you're putting them back into the employer's pocket. And I said, yeah, and that's the reason why we're going to have a lot of success, and we're going to grow. And they said, well, that's not something we want to have happen. Now, it doesn't. You know, this is right in the front of everybody right now. A great slide that one of our advisors uses shows the stock price of the five biggest health insurance companies in our country and what they've done over the last 10 years. United Healthcare, Aetna, Cigna. And you look at how quickly and how, I mean, one of the, I mean, you know, the best thing to do if you can't beat them, buy their stock, but buy your health insurance from Roundstone because they're making money hand over fist in the current environment, but it's starting to change, and people are starting to move to Roundstone.
What are the three things, if there were three things that you wanted to communicate to people in management positions of why they should consider Roundstone, what are those three things?
First off, we will allow you to curtail this top three expense from going up double digits every year. Number two, we're turnkey, so you don't have to go out and hire a bunch of insurance professionals or healthcare professionals. We deliver a turnkey solution. It's not added work. And three, this approach is good business. And Roundstone's, you know, philosophy and mission of curtailing cost increases is something that will help your company, not just from a P&L point of view, but from a health and wellness of all of these employees point of view. And so from a culture point of view for your company, it's a very positive change. But if I can stop, if Roundstone can offer the opportunity to curtail a top three expense from doubling every 4 years, we can do so in a low work turnkey fashion, and I can improve the culture and health and wellness of your company, I think that's a company you should probably want to talk to.
Mike Schroeder, your website again?
RoundstoneInsurance.com. RoundstoneInsurance, insurance, INSURANCE.com.
Thank you so much for being with us. And we really do have to invite you back and have a conversation about how we can better explore this for our audience.
Well, thank you for having me, and I would love to talk to you anytime.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
Josh Halpern heads Getting to Global, the first and only citizen-first trade support aggregator that consolidates multiple government agencies and taps the likes of Google, Facebook, and eBay. It's a very interesting approach, and Josh is here to tell us about it today. I guess, Josh, my first question is a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your organization, and where people can find you. So we'll start right now. Sure. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Don. Okay, so I used to run the retail logistics e-commerce portfolios for the U.S. Embassy in China for about 5 years as a foreign service officer for the Department of Commerce. I was asked under the former administration to come back and launch the e-commerce innovation lab in Silicon Valley, with the express focus of exponentially increasing exports by helping SMEs sell through e-commerce overseas. It very quickly developed something called the E-Commerce Export Council, which is really an industry-led thought, I guess you could call it think tank, trying to figure out how to do this in an actionable way, and that slowly morphed into what is now one of the largest public-private partnerships in the U.S. called the Getting to Global Initiative, where we really galvanize support from industry, Facebook, Google, eBay, Pitney Bowes, and USPS and SBA, as government partners as well, and try to figure out how do we get the right data and services to SMEs to help them export. And we do that online, and we do it through workshops around the country. I can tell you more, but you tell me how much more you want to know.
Well, I guess my first question, I want to make it clear. Are you a private company or a government agency?
It's a private, non-profit, non-lobbying initiative, and it's partnered with strategic sign partnerships with the Small Business Administration and with the U.S. Postal Service. And then we are supported by Google, Facebook, eBay, and Pitney Bowes, as well as other smaller companies. And then we have signed agreements with different associations that work with larger groups of SMEs in everything from auto parts to cosmetics to retail to manufacturing.
Well, I'm going to turn it over to Dan now because this is something that I think he has more familiarity with.
Thank you, and welcome to the show, Josh. When you say you're a support aggregator, why don't you tell our audience what it is, what is the service that you provide to your customers?
Sure. What we do, and we do this for free for SMEs, we fast-track them to the right government solutions or industry solutions that will get them to the markets that are appropriate. For example, we take a company, let's say like Lime Crime, an exploding cosmetics company that's really only been able to explode in the market globally because of access to tools that are only available really in the last year or two. And those are the data that Google, for example, Google Market Finder might provide, or Facebook's Cross-Border Insights Finder. These types of tools that allow them to figure out what are the right markets for them, based on search words, based on what, you know, who's searching for what, who's asking for what, who's buying what. And then we say, okay, let's look at a platform that might work for you for these markets that are appropriate, vis-a-vis a marketplace like eBay or others, do you want to go direct across border? What kind of solutions are available for you? Is it financing and insurance from an Ex-Im Bank? And if so, what's the local bank in your area based on very limited information we need from the company, mostly their website, and we find the right loans and insurance and providers for them. We look at SBA grants, and we fast-track them to those solutions. And then we look at, okay, now if you're going to go overseas, what is the right payment solution that might work for you per your size of company, per your target, where your pain points are? What are some incremental service providers that can get you to where you want to go, but without a bigger spend? For example, pop-ups on your site that may welcome foreign companies or foreign buyers that you wouldn't have to build out a site for. So there's the reason why we believe this is a fundamental shift and an important shift in how we service or help SMEs export is because it's not isolated to a government solution or an industry solution. There's a basket of solutions that cross over both public and private that need to be aggregated, if you will, or placed together and provided to an SME in an actionable way. And up until now, what you have is government and industry working not necessarily in tandem, and a lot of federal regulations and legacy software that's kind of holding certain government entities back from really servicing SMEs at the pace that they need to be serviced. And then you have industry having a very separate track where they discuss things with SMEs. So we want to try and merge those two. I can talk a little bit further about one of the aspects that why this is critical now and how this is, I think, a new model for how we should be approaching a lot of pain points, if that's useful, Dan.
Well, I was just thinking about the previous guest we had who's got a proprietary software for small businesses that's dealing with ransomware across computers, and they found that there seems to be a significant need, not that the enterprise systems don't need them, but that the small business people that maybe only have two or three or five computers, there's an ever-increasing demand for that, and I would assume that that's not just unique to the United States, but could be, in fact, globally. So would he come to you and say, I've got this, I'm doing business in the U.S. and I'm going gangbusters, but I want to bring it to the...
Yes. So, for example, if he were... There's two sides of ways that we would help him, and what I call kind of a 360, let's call it SME Export Incubator, where you take a service provider like that that's focused on helping SMEs that has a price that's appropriate for that market. And we say, okay, first of all, let's profile your solution to other product or service online exporters. Let's take a look at where the market is, and let's profile them via video interviews on our site. Let's profile them via integrating them into the tool. So if the right size company looking for the right market that he's exceptionally good at helping deal with, make sure that they see and have understanding of what those services are. So and that perspective, we want to help bring those types of service providers to the, that market. In terms of as in his own right, as a SaaS solution or as a, some sort of a software export, we would look at, we would connect with him and we'd look at our tool and we'd say, okay, who's searching for cryptocurrency linked or fraud indicator or fraud solution, mitigation solutions in different markets around the world? And we'd say, okay, here are five countries where people are searching most for your services. And if you're going to go into these markets, here's how you might want to launch a campaign that would be combined between Facebook and maybe Google. Here's how we would track some top some of the expos happening in that area or some of our network. Maybe take a case study of his, get it over to their overseas market and try to help promote that. And these are ways that we do things, and we're non-biased in the sense that we're not saying, okay, great, now go launch a Google AdWords campaign. Obviously, Facebook and Google are both equal partners on this, and we try to find the right solution and basket of solutions that can help.
So let me take it to a, I was going to say absurd, but maybe not absurd. There's been a lot of news recently in the United States about the explosion of the growth of the fracking oil industry in the Dakotas and Texas, and that we are shortly about ready to cross the 10 million barrels of crude oil a day and quickly approaching Saudi Arabia and Russia in terms of absolute production. So it could be by the end of this year, we could be the largest oil producer in the world. But let's just say that I'm XYZ shale oil company in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I'm a small oil company, but I'd like to get tapped into providing oil to overseas markets. Can I come to you and you can help me?
I'd say right now, in the short term, our focus and our tagline is sell more online overseas. So there's part of that, which means we're trying to help companies that either have product or services that they need to either sell or build their brands overseas. We also help manufacturers, but we would help manufacturers like what you're talking about, probably more on the digital brand building and connection part, that initial stage of, hey, who's searching for it? Who are some of the target audiences? And how can we fast track you? But I'd say that's probably not our core focus right now on attracting larger, for example, institutional buyers that may not actually transact online.
So let's back up. Who, Josh? Who in the United States today is the supplier, manufacturer, whatever the right word is? Who is that organization, that person you are looking for to help? Who are they?
So I'll give you a few examples. In cosmetics manufacturers and brands like Line Prime, 100% Pure, these are brands that are clearly pure play e-commerce platforms. They're trying, for example, 100% Pure has 600% plus growth in a year, so shifting the focus from domestic U.S. to really China. And they want to understand, do I go on Alibaba? If I do, do I do on the Tmall Global or a Tmall asset, meaning in-country or cross-border fulfillment? If I want to now expand to Korea or, let's say, Rakuten in Japan, what is the best solution for me? And how do I deal with, let's say, payment solution so that I can localize my payments, reduce or mitigate some of the intermediary expenditures that happen when multiple banks are talking? How do I build my brand incrementally? All those types of things. That's something I would help with 100% Pure, with Line Crime, Revolve Clothing, 600 to 800 million dollar annual revenue now, still considered as a startup. They're looking at clothing and apparel and how do you go to a play. But then on the other side of it, you look at a manufacturer of, let's say, aftermarket auto supplies that's saying, hey, I want to attract and focus on aftermarket auto outfitting and services solutions in other markets. So that's a B2B brick-and-mortar sale play, but they want to track the right audience, and they want to see if there's a B2B marketplace in a given market they should go into. Those are the types of companies you would be looking at supporting.
So,
and those are
I'm the XYZ company, and I've come up with a great new product, a widget that does wonderful things that nobody else has ever done before. And I've been selling it online, and I want to expand my market by opening up markets outside the United States. I come to you. Do I pay a fee to you?
No, there's no fee for us. It's, we're birthed out of a – that's the public body part of it. We're birthed out of a really information on online and fast-tracking people to the services in really a self-service model. Our model is very simple. The more SMEs that we help effectively find the right solutions for them to keep them coming back to find more solutions, the more the service providers will be interested in being visible on our channel. And then it's our job to make sure that we're not, to use a risky term, we're not pimping out a service provider just because they're paying us to have access to the site. Where our job is to maintain that impartial kind of best in service solution, whether it's government or industry.
So, okay. So where do you are you saying you get your money from Google and all these other sponsors that you've talked about as opposed to my tax dollars, or do you get some of my tax dollars too?
So I don't get money from tax. I don't get money from government or tax money. We get money from Google, Facebook, eBay, Pitney Bowes, and others. And we get money from them not to promote or not really to sell their services, but to actually be visible as a support network for SMEs. And the first the signature that they sign on our commitment letter is that this is a 100% neutral platform, and we will be offering competitive services to theirs, but we allow them to be kind of the front and center supporters of an SME export initiative.
And so because a lot of our listeners are not necessarily interested in dealing with the government, what is an FME?
Sure. A small and medium enterprise, and that's a very vague term, especially an antiquated term in today's world, which should really go away. Some of the definitions include 500 employees or less. If you look at companies like Revolve or Movement Watches or others, these are companies with maybe 100 or less employees, but they're selling at massive revenue per year, whereas you look at another traditional model, and they may have many more. So SME is very focused. What I would say is we're not enterprise level in the sense that we're not looking to help companies that says, hey, we've got $500,000 to go into the market. How should we do it? But that's great. You probably have a few employees that can help you, and yeah, we can introduce you to a few people, but we're really trying to focus on the company that has a little bit more tighter purse strings.
So what is how long have you been around?
We started this about a year and a half ago, and we officially launched in October 24th of last year.
So how are you promoting? How are you promoting it?
So hopefully in the link to this podcast, we've run labs in Los Angeles at the Port of Los Angeles called Global E-Commerce Workshops. We run these around the country. We're running another one next week at NRF Retail's Big Show. We're calling it the Global Influencer Open Studios, where we interview people around their expertise. We'll be Facebook Living that on our Facebook channel at facebook.com/gettingtheglobal. And we're basically, we go to expos around the country and then do our own stand-up events where we just capture everything that is useful in terms of global. And we put it on our Facebook. And then we put it on our site and blog posts that happen every week. If you go to gettingglobal.org, you can see insights already from interviews we've done. I've been conducting interviews for a long time, so we have a fair amount of content on there already. And then we'll be running another lab at ETL West in Palm Springs, February 26th. That's outside of LA, where we do a whole full day Getting to Global Summit, talking with leaders in different industries. We'll talk to bigger companies like Perry Ellis, who's head of international, to Revolve Kylie, to smaller companies like Coco Jack, that has a really interesting, you know, coconut opener. Those types of companies will be on stage, and I'll be drilling into them on how does it actually work. And that's one of the big things that I'm passionate about, is I don't do panels, and I don't do vague discussions. We drill into one-on-one, an interview on stage or on videos, and we say, how do you do it? Okay, tell me what you're saying. You're clicking this, and then you're doing that. Well, how much does that cost? What are we doing about this? Let's really get to the bottom of it so that a company can turn around tomorrow and start taking action.
So we have between our regular show, which is on a network, and we probably, between our show and Roku, probably have in the neighborhood of 250,000 people a week who listen to our show. And I got to tell you, until today, I never heard of, not you personally, but what you have. And now I understand it's only been out about since October of last year. Is there any interest of trying to tap into our small business opportunity with the hundreds of thousands of people that we have to try and get people to drive to your website or whatever, or are we going to overload you?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I would say that the first thing is to digest our content, our videos and our blogs, both on our site and on our Facebook. But then, you know, what we can do is come back even with a partner, and I can – like, for example, next week we're doing a webinar, January 17th, 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, with Google and one of the Google clients. And I'll be talking to them about how do they use their tool, their new Global Market Finder tool, to actually help companies figure out what markets to go into. And so those are types of things we can also do. We can share it with your audience, both in post-production or during, or we can also come up with, I can bring on some of these partners to talk about their tools. The big thing I do is I will never have a service writer on there without a client that has used their service, because it can't be a one-dimensional pitch. It has to be a useful insight from a company that gets nothing other than they found this tool useful. So, you know, okay. I'm happy to engage. I'd love to engage with your audience and, anytime.
I'm fascinated by what Josh does. And it's something that's definitely needed.
I agree, because I think that I'm not trying to editorialize here, John, Josh. I'm just saying that our experience is that as we've talked to hundreds upon hundreds of small business people on our show, and that there's one thing that's very clear, and it's not a great revolution, but just to hear it time and time again in every kind of business you can imagine. Everybody's using the internet as the basis to launch their businesses. They're not going after bricks and mortar stores. And it just seems to me that if I understand what you're offering, is you're offering the ability for a startup, a small business who has something unique and different, to figure out how to open up the world to their business. And I think that's a terrific idea, and we should try and figure out a way to partner that we can bring that information and a style and a structure that would work for you and work for us. So we'll contact you in the next 24 to 48 hours.
Sure, great. There's a great guy by the name of Travis Bard, who runs Speed Outfitters, motorcycling gear for people around around the world. It's high performance. It's a small company out of Ohio. This company, when all of their friends during the recession were getting hit hard, they were growing exceptionally well. And they consider going global. Since you're global on day one, if you focus on it, it's a recession mitigator, if you will. So as they were growing, they go through eBay and their global shipping program, which is powered, I think, by Pitney Bowes. They click on a switch, and essentially they're selling into 10 to 20 countries around the world, and they get most of their business now overseas. This is a small company that can do it, because now, unlike a year or two ago, the kinks have been worked out in a large part, and they flip a switch and they're servicing, and they're not even dealing with the import-export papers and all the other stuff, because you're actually selling as if you're selling to a Pitney Bowes solution in the U.S., and that solution buys it at the point that the overseas consumer buys it. Thus, it's all taken care of by PB, and you get an invoice from PB. That's an example of it, of some of these companies that can do things now that they could never otherwise do.
We have a business. Our show is about small business, growing your small business. Why shouldn't that show be exported around the world?
Yeah. The difference, and this is one of the things that's actually funny, this is one of the things we're working on with our, what we're launching this Export Accelerator tool, is that based on your IP address, if you're coming from a certain location around the world, you should see that country-specific information. There are certain service providers that can't help somebody from Uzbekistan sell into, you know, Brazil. But there are certain service providers or government solutions even that can be offered by that government. And so we are looking at ways we can do that. So, yeah, but if you were going to be selling in general, the insights are universal, especially in markets that I would target, like Amazon and eBay markets, where they already have the infrastructure set up. Or China, for example, outbound into other markets, so they'll need to deal with translation. But if you looked at if you look at certain markets, the UK would be a good way to start, I think, because of the language you've got in the marketplace.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that the information that we're disseminating and have been disseminating over a year is not country-specific in the sense that it only works. The basic principles of how you run your business doesn't make any difference whether you're in the United States, England, China, Korea, or Brazil. The basic principles are there, and we have the ability to deliver the knowledge from people who have succeeded or people who are building businesses on what kind of problems and challenges that they've occurred. I understand that the language barrier in some areas would be a problem, but if everybody's trying to – if small business is the way the world grows, knowledge – I don't know of anybody that's exporting, if you would – the kind of knowledge that we have. And you can go back on our website, recalculating.biz, and look at two shows a week for the last year, and you look at some of the people that we've had on, the products and the diversity of product. I mean, we're providing a lot of information on the problems that people are having and the opportunities and the challenges and how they're solving it. And my question to you is, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, where do they go to get that? Where do they get the opportunity to talk to other entrepreneurs, listen to other entrepreneurs who are talking about what they've done to make them business successful or what problems they're facing or whatever? Where is that? Why isn't this knowledge exportable?
First of all, I agree. I think it is. I speak to one market in particular. There's organizations in India that I work with, and the Indian market, and wants to understand how do you start exporting. I think what's happening time right now, people don't maybe understand that traditionally government offers these services, and they do it, for example, through the UK trade or Canada trade or these other government or U.S. government Department of Commerce. They do it that way because previously industry didn't feel it was worth it. There wasn't a business case to create these smaller priced solutions. Now, because of data and scalability, companies like Google, Pitney Bowes, Facebook, et cetera, and solutions like what you're talking about, these educators, all these different solutions are ready for helping the SME globally. And now is the time, and this is where it has to be right. Private industry can take on this role and should of helping educate the SME because it makes business sense too. And you can so in doing so, I'm happy to work with you on it. I think maybe one of the things you could do is look at some of your content and maybe export it through a partnership in India, Australia. We'll be in Australia later this year, running a global summit there. So there's a lot of ways we could work together, and I'm happy to do it.
Well, thank you for giving us all this extra time, and thank you for joining us on the show today. And you sound like you have an exciting thing, and we'll look forward to talking to you in the next 24 to 40 hours, and I'll throw it back to Don.
Our guest has been Josh Halpern, who heads Getting to Global. A link to his website will be on recalculatingbiz.biz tonight. You can hear this and every other recalculating program on recalculating.biz. Josh, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.